are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
In Revelation chapter 8, John begins by giving us a prelude to the trumpet judgments. At this point, we are now about halfway through the tribulation period, if you want to think in a timeline that way. We see in this passage here that Christ himself will open these seals. This is one of those chapters in Revelation, Revelation 8, that you can get Christ out of view as you get interested in these judgments that are happening. They're so severe. But we have to remember that at the beginning of this chapter, who is first mentioned? It's Christ. He is the one that opens the seventh seal, that authorizes these seven trumpets to blow. And so all of these things happen with Christ's authority and Christ's authorization. Christ will authorize these events, and they will be more extraordinary and intense than the ones before. When we read this, we should realize that each of these judgments come from Christ himself and demonstrate with even greater intensity his ferocity as a lion in judgment. His justice is ferocious. Our Lord is not just a meek and lowly lamb. He is a ferocious lion in his justice. We also read in this prelude to the trumpet judgments, a brief period of silence precedes them. Now, up to this point in Revelation, how would you describe the volume level in the throne room? Was it the kind of place where you could hear a pin drop? Was it a hush-hush room? How would you describe the volume? It was loud. It was noisy. In fact, the volume continues to increase as you hear thunderings and lightnings at the throne, and you hear the four angelic worship leaders crying out, and you hear the elders calling out and worshiping and speaking, and then the crowd of angels around them worshiping the Lamb with anthems of praise. And then you have martyrs at the altar praying out loud, crying at the top of their lungs for justice. And then you have multitudes, uncountable number of other believers surrounding and singing in praise as well. The volume continues to rise. And then Revelation 8 is quiet. I'm sure that would get your attention. You're drawn into all this action, the sights and sounds that John saw, and then silence. And John says for about half an hour. Now, I don't know how you can measure time in the throne room. How do you measure time in the heavenly dimension? John doesn't necessarily say in this case, in the throne room, there was silence for 30 minutes. I timed it. I looked at the sundial on the beach on Patmos Island and I counted. There's no way to do that. He doesn't do that. Instead, what he's saying, as a human being who knows life in this world, what he saw or heard, or rather didn't hear, lasted from what he could tell as a human being for like half an hour. That's what it felt like anyway. It was a long enough time that you get a little uneasy. Imagine you came to Faith Baptist Church and we sang for half an hour to prepare for a worship service, and all of a sudden it was quiet and everyone stopped talking. Well, after about a minute, that would be strange. After about 5 minutes, that would be unusual. 30 minutes? You'd be wondering, what's going on here? We've been sitting here for 30 minutes. I'm getting uneasy. We would get very uneasy just at 30 minutes, wouldn't we? What was about to happen, especially after all the noise? After this time, this silence indicates perhaps yet again Christ's long-suffering before he, as it were, pulled the trigger on the next level of intensity. Perhaps it also indicates the ominous nature of what is about to happen, drawing our attention to it so we don't miss it. Now think about it this way. Imagine that you are sitting in a symphony hall, maybe Carnegie Hall, and you're listening to a great symphony, and the orchestra plays the whole first movement. Let's say that's the Seal Judgments. They play the whole first movement in 6 to 7 parts, and it all crescendos to a loud sound as the last seal with all the trumpets. Now, as we look at the trumpet judgments tonight, I want you to notice that just like the first seals, the 7 seals, the first 4 appeared as a group. What distinguished that group as a group, if you remember? They each had a horse and a rider, right? A different color, but a horse and a rider came out. In this case, the first 4 also are grouped together in chapter 8, but not by a horse and rider, but by things happening in the sky. And it does seem to have some correlation, perhaps, at least from a vision standpoint, of that angel taking that censer, casting down the incense and the ashes of those prayers onto the earth. And then these things come falling out of the sky. And then the final 3, we'll see later, the final 3 trumpets are not in this chapter. They follow later. They appear as a unit of themselves. And there is this pattern in the first 7 seals of 4 and then 3, and again 4 and 3. And there's no deep significance to the numbers 4 and 3, but there is a pattern, and we can notice that, and it shows order. These events are not chaos. They are not pandemonium. From the world's perspective, they may feel that way and likely will, but from the believer who understands, we know there is order to the chaos. There's a God who's in control. He does things, and there's 4 of them. He does 3, and he's 4 again, and then there's 3. Then each of these are 7. It's perfect. This is the plan that he is working out, one step methodically after another. This is not a God also in his wrath who has flown like the pagan Roman gods into a rage. This is no royal rage where God is just going around throwing a temper tantrum from heaven, showing how awfully angry he is, that he has now reached the last nerve and his foot is finally coming down. No, this is a God who has carefully controlled his wrath in long-suffering, compassion, and mercy for centuries. And even when the last shoe drops, there is still order and control with bits of patience and long-suffering sprinkled in. The Lord himself never flies into a rage, even in his greatest moments of wrath. And these numbers and these groupings show that he is just as much a God of order when he created the world as he is when he destroys it. These 7 trumpets are as follows. The first one, vegetation will be devastated and destroyed. The second one will move from the land to the ocean, and the oceans will be polluted. Then from the oceans, we move inland to the fresh water, which will be contaminated. And then we will lift our eyes to heaven, and the lights of the solar system will be darkened. And that will affect us on earth. And then there are 3 more judgments, final 3 trumpets, and we'll study those in later lessons. And these get very interesting. There'll be a plague of venomous locusts that will crawl out from the abyss deep within the earth. Locusts, creatures that we have never classified or discovered to date. And they will be awful creatures. Hellish creatures. Number six, there will be a massacre on after that by a horde of demonic armies unleashed upon the earth. And then the seventh trumpet will blow, and there will be an arrival, an official announcement that God's kingdom is now moving into place. Let's talk about the first four trumpet judgments tonight. The first of the four trumpet judgments is the destruction of vegetation. The angel in heaven will blow his trumpet. And when he blows his trumpet, there will be a widespread hailstorm that will rain down upon the earth. Hail and fire followed, mingled with blood. They were thrown to the earth. Now, these trumpet judgments, especially the first four, have strong resemblances to something else. As we read this, did anyone think about what this might be? Did these four judgments remind you vaguely of something else that has happened in the Bible before? Perhaps the plagues that God sent to the region of Egypt when he freed his people Israel from slavery. If you study the Old Testament prophets, they do use descriptions from God's plagues on Egypt to deliver Israel from bondage to foreshadow what will happen in a larger way at the end of time. This is not a one-for-one equal pattern here. These things don't happen in the exact same way, in the exact same order. There's four, obviously, and not ten. But the same kinds of things happen. In this particular case, you can look at Exodus chapter 9, verses 23 through 25, if you're interested. And it describes the seventh plague on Egypt, when hailstones mixed with fire rained down on the sky over Egypt. Now, it's possible sometimes to ask the question when you read Revelation, is this telling me what actually will happen, or is this just figurative? It's just poetic, but the actual thing is not going to happen, just something kind of like that. Or something will happen spiritually that is being described in physical terms. But it's really hard to even suggest that, for instance, in this judgment and the series of judgments, because something very much like it actually, historically, has already occurred. It wasn't figurative hailstones and pretend fire or spiritual fire that came down on Egypt. It was actual fire and hail. And similar terminology is used here. The difference here, though, is that this judgment will not just affect a local area, it will affect the entire world. Another major difference is what is added by John: hail and fire followed, mingled, mixed, intermixed with blood. If you get caught outside, out from under shelter when this happens, when God throws these things down to the earth, not only will you get bruises, not only will you get scorched parts on your skin, you also have blood spatters as well. Because all three of those things are going to come raining down out of the sky. I wonder what the weather forecaster's screen will look like on that day. Will he have the right graphics in his computer or software program to show on the screen what is happening outside? Maybe not. It's interesting because in Joel chapter 2, verses 30 to 31, the prophet Joel uses these kind of qualities to describe the nature of things that will happen in that great day of the Lord, the tribulation period. And he says, in that time, here's some of the things that are going to happen. I will show you wonders in the heavens and in the earth. And certainly, this book of Revelation shows us there'll be extraordinary things happening in the sky and on the land, on the earth. Some of those things will be blood and fire and columns of smoke. The pillars of smoke likely refer to things like volcanic activity coming up from the earth. We've already talked about that, right? The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. What Joel is saying here is not a tight sequence of events. This is just a grab bag of concepts that are going to be the kind of things that happen in the tribulation period. And when you see these kind of things, you will know what period you are in. And here we see some of these things happen. The results of this judgment will be devastating. John describes it. A third of all the trees will be burned. Now, we're used to seeing this about every September, right? On national news, when we check out what's happening in California and on the West Coast. And what do we see? All kinds of videos of forest fires devastating large acres of land. But as great as that is, that's probably not a third of all the trees in California. It's just a lot. Can you imagine what would happen if what just was described falls down on the earth and the result of that is a third of all trees in the world? Imagine the Northwoods of Canada, a third of them going away. All the trees of New York City being scorched. A third. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean a third of all the trees in every literal location, but if you take all the trees in the world, at the very least, a third of them will be destroyed. What is the effect of that alone on the world and our quality of life? That will take away a major source of food production and affect our economy. Those of you who like your coffee are going to have to think hard about paying what it will cost if it's even available after this is done. You like your cocoa beans? You like your citrus fruits and your apples? They're going to go up in smoke. At least a third of them are. And then what's the bigger result of a third of all tree life being destroyed? Okay, use your earth science. Use your ecology knowledge. What do trees produce? They are the premier source of oxygen in the world, giving us breathable quality air, right? Well, imagine a third of all oxygen producers being destroyed. On top of that, that's just the trees, all the grass will be burned up. Not a third of it, all of it. All grass, shrubbery, these kind of things. What does that affect? That's going to affect things like, and if you're from the Indochina region, you will really understand this. That's going to affect things like grains, rice, things of that nature. And then over here in the west part of the world, things like soybeans and corn. These are the things that will be destroyed, not just the lawn in front that you have to mow. That you might not actually mind seeing go away. But it's all the other, the grains and these kind of things. And let's remember, too, that every green leaf produces oxygen. And so our oxygen supply is going to take a significant hit, a third of it, actually probably more, because all grass is going to go away. Our oxygen quality will depreciate. Our food supply will depreciate. This will affect our economy as well as our nutrition. And that's just the first trumpet. The second trumpet. This trumpet unleashes another judgment on the world, but it will affect not the land, but the water and a part of the water. Now, when we talk about this, let me also point out something you may have mentioned that stands out in these judgments, the trumpet judgments, there is a percentage that stands out and is used of everything that results from these judgments, except for a couple. When it says that all the grass is destroyed, that's 100%. When it says many people die as a result of one of these trumpets, it doesn't give you a percentage, it just says many. And then there's another place where it says, let me find it. Many men will die, and then there's another thing that is mentioned, but it doesn't say a third. Everything else is a third of this, and a third of that, and a third of that. And the point there is, A, yes, God is in control. He doesn't do things, and then whatever happens to die, happens to die. And then he says, that was more than I bargained for, or that wasn't enough. No, if a third dies, that means the one who holds the keys of life and death is not just in control of the judgments, he's in control of the results. And even there, he is orderly. But it also, this a third, also helps us to visualize the degree and magnitude of the devastation. A third is a large percentage. So keep that in mind. Trumpet number two is when another thing falls from the sky. Things like to fall from the sky when trumpets are blown here. But this time it's not a meteoroid or a hail shower. It's not a hail storm. It's one object that just comes hurling out of the sky. And John describes it, again, best as he can. He doesn't say, and I saw a mountain falling out of the sky. Now, we know this is not a volcano, at least the kind we know about, because volcanoes don't fall out of the sky. What they blow out falls out of the sky, but they themselves don't come hurling out of the sky. So what John saw was not something he'd ever seen before, and he couldn't describe it in a way that we would say, I know what that is. I went to the zoo this week with some friends and my family and saw a lot of animals. Some of them I know what they are. Some of them I looked at and I didn't know what they were. And if I had to tell you what that animal looked like and what it was, all I could do is say, well, it kind of looked like this animal and this animal, but it wasn't like either one. It was like both of them. It was kind of like that. And that's what John is doing. He says, I saw, well, what I saw was, it was like a massive mountain that was burning, falling out of the sky. I don't know what that is. I can try to see what John saw as best as I can. And that's what he saw. So visualize that. And this mountain falling out of the sky that's burning. Also, this must have been very massive if the word great is used and mountain was the closest thing he could come to think of it. When it fell down, it landed in the ocean. At first you might say, well, that's better than landing on the earth. At least it would splash down. Well, it lands in the ocean, and as a result, one third of all the oceans turned to blood. Well, that's kind of graphic. That's unexpected. I didn't do the research to figure out exactly what that would equal on our globe as it is today, but I know we've got the Indian Ocean and the Antarctic Ocean, the Arctic Ocean, we've got the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. Am I missing an ocean? Am I missing one? I think that's all the oceans. Let's just say we take one of them. Let's take the Atlantic Ocean. Turn that to blood and leave the rest fresh. That's a lot of blood. That's a lot of devastation. What is the result of this? I mean, what are the outcomes of that actually happening? Once this big thing falls into the ocean and this happens, John tells us that a third of all marine life will die. I mean, they're not designed to live in blood. And you can also extrapolate that out. If that many animals die that rapidly, what happens to them. Their carcasses will rise to the surface. And so you'll have a mass graveyard of floating death in a pool of blood, a third of the oceans. Now, we know that oceans are very saline, and so these carcasses will die quite rapidly, but there's going to be a lot of mess, let's put it that way, an awful stench. And also it says a third of all ships will be destroyed. Now, you might read that and say, ships will be destroyed. Okay, what's next? That's not very interesting to us at first, because a lot of us don't see ships very often. We don't think about ships very often. And unless you're like a few people that we know who like to take cruises, you don't ride ships very often. Ships are not a major part of our life, are they? We're more familiar with other forms of transportation, like bicycles and scooters and cars and trucks and subways and, around here, airplanes, because we see them flying all the time over our heads. We even hear them when we're trying to sleep sometimes. Well, you might be surprised to know how extremely important ships are to your life. They may be the most important form of transportation to your life. Let me give you some statistics. According to the International Chamber of Shipping, and this is as of studies that I looked up today, the international shipping industry today is responsible for transporting approximately 90% of world trade. The other 10% would be semi-trucks and airplanes and things like that. 90% on ships. Ironically, as advanced as we are today in society, that's the same percentage of 500 years ago. We're still relying heavily on ships, despite our technological advancements. Without shipping, the transport of raw materials, affordable goods, things that make manufacturing and import and export commerce possible, all of these things would collapse if you remove shipping. 90%. You probably couldn't build your house. You probably couldn't buy your clothing. Think about all the things that you have in your life that came from another part of the world and came here on a ship. You wouldn't have much without ships. You wouldn't have much food without ships. Over 50,000, this is where numbers help us think through what is a third. Over 50,000 merchant ships are trading internationally right now on the waters, transporting every kind of cargo. The world fleet is registered in over 150 nations and manned by over a million sailors and captains from almost every nationality. Okay, put that in perspective. We probably haven't even counted fishing boats and things like that on the coasts. From these statistics, we can say that, okay, if 10% of commerce, the other 10% happens on land, and a lot of that is based upon grain and fruit transport and things like that. If a large percentage of that crashes with the first trumpet, and then a third of all shipping crashes with the second trumpet, you are probably going to be getting dangerously close to a 50% collapse in the world economy. This is where math helps with Bible study. Interesting, right? Got to know your stuff. We're talking about getting down to that 55%. That's huge. I mean, today, if the stock market, just one part of the stock market in one part of the world, goes down 3%, everyone goes into a mild panic. 5% would be alarming. 10% would be a crash. Can you imagine in a space of time a 30 to 50%, well, more than 30, 40 to 50% drop? Everything shuts down. All of this is just the second trumpet. And this is what you should be thinking when you're reading, oh, and a third of the ships died, or stopped working. Why did the ship stop, by the way? Well, a third of them are in the third of the oceans where the water turns to blood. What happens then? At the very least, you start getting a bunch of dead animals sucked up into your engines, and it more than your designer planned for. The engineer didn't account for that. Perhaps it's because the engines themselves get blood built up in them and they just stop working. Or perhaps, there's another possibility, perhaps when this great mammoth mountain thing falls into the earth and hits the oceans, perhaps it creates great tidal waves that causes a third of the ships to be destroyed. If that's the case, there's no time for airlift rescues. We're talking about a third of the 1 million sailors out there or more will also die. So just extrapolate this out. Use your imagination. See what John saw and think about it. Let's move on to trumpet number 3. The third trumpet, when it blows, will now affect the fresh water on land. So we've affected the dry land. We've affected the oceans. Now, moving inland, something else falls out of the sky. And this time, it says, it'll be something like a large asteroid, a great star. A large asteroid fell from heaven, burning like a torch. Another large object on fire coming out of the sky. The first one looked more like a mountain on fire. The second one looks more like a burning star. That's how John is trying to tell the difference for us. But let's face it, these are burning, massive objects falling out of the sky. And this one lands on fresh water. And the way the waters flow, it affects and contaminates all freshwater springs and a third of all streams and rivers. This is the drinking water now, not just the trade routes. Now we're talking about drinking water, the life of humanity, water. We can live a little bit longer without grain, but we can't live very long without water. And so he tells us in the vision he also saw, this asteroid actually was given a name. It was called Wormwood. What does that mean? Is this some kind of demon thing or whatever? No, the idea here is it's called Wormwood because it's describing the characteristic of this object. And when it falls to the ground and it hits the fresh water supply, it's going to cause all of the water, a third of it, to become bitter. And that word wormwood is a word that is the name for a bitter herb that was very prevalent and grew in different varieties in Palestine in John's lifetime, and it still grows today. This plant features an especially bitter taste. You don't necessarily die because you taste it or take it in. It's not automatically poisonous. It's just very bitter. If you've ever licked a battery, don't ever do that. If you've ever tasted acid, you know what bitter is, okay? It's worse than a lemon. And we're not talking just sour, bitter. It's just bitter by itself. And if you take it in large doses, you may have some very bad reactions. And I did a little research, not in math now, but science. And here's what I discovered. That wormwood, this herb, if taken in large doses, can cause digestive problems, kidney failure, nausea, seizures, sleeplessness, vomiting, and for some people and for some dosages, death. But a third of the fresh water supply in the world is going to have this quality. Some people are going to have to take their chances, and they're going to have to drink it, and they're not going to have filtration devices that readily available to deal with this new problem. It's fascinating to know that, well, John says many people will die as a result. And if you study the Old Testament prophets again, and I give some references in Jeremiah and Lamentations, the prophets used this plant, wormwood, to describe the nature of God's judgment. Finally, trumpet number 4 will blow, and you might be surprised that in this case, nothing falls out of the sky, which that's kind of the point. What is supposed to fall out of the sky on a normal day? Light. But less of it is going to come down when the trumpet blows. When the fourth trumpet blows, somehow or another, 1/3 of the sun will go dark. Either 1/3 of the sun will go dark, or the sun will go dark by 1/3 in its lightness, its degree of light. 1/3 of the moon, same thing. 1/3 of it will black out or will lessen by 1/3 in its light intensity. And 1/3, the same thing will happen to all the stars. 1/3 of them will go black, or all of them will dim 1/3, or something like this. The result of that, John says, is that we will have less light by 1/3 on the earth, and in fact, 1/3 of daytime will be pitch black, and 1/3 of nighttime will be pitch black. So you take our daily routine and you add 6 hours of pitch blackness. That's what's going to happen. What's going to be the result of that? Well, let's think about this from a scientific perspective. You take all of this darkness and you put it into our daily schedules, it'll be like living on the dark side of Alaska half of the year, when they don't see the sun hardly at all. And in those parts of the world, there are greater rates of depression, drunkenness, mental illness, fear, anxiety, isolation. These are the effects, and we feel that even now as we have longer, darker nights in the wintertime, we have a tendency to get a little bit depressed. And I have noticed, little sidelight, as a pastor, spiritual struggles do tend to sometimes increase a little bit during these times of year. And it's not always for a spiritual reason. It's for an objective reason. We're living in a more dark period of time, and we need to recognize that, or we can get into ourselves. But this is going to be what happens. Also, there'll probably be an increase in things like crime, right, and so on. Not to mention what happens when you take that much sunlight out of our daily routines. We lose important dosages of vitamin C or D that will cause immune and nutritional deficiencies on a massive scale. That may itself not seem so bad, but when you blend this together with all the other things going on in the first four trumpets, things are going to be in a very devastated situation. You might say, wow, this is just the fourth. And you should say, wow, this is just the fourth. In fact, that's what happens in verse 13. Our Bible says an angel, John said, saw fly through the midst of the sky, which means he's not now looking at something flying in the throne room up in heaven. What he's seeing is something more down in the terrestrial sphere. Kind of look up. Look, it's Superman. No, it's not Superman. It's an angel flying through the sky. But most manuscripts actually have the word eagle instead, and that may actually be what John saw. I won't get into why that's probably the case, but imagine an eagle flying through the sky and crying out. What is it that's being cried out? I looked, and I heard an eagle flying through the midst of the sky, saying with a loud voice, wow. In our modern terminology, this would be wow, wow, wow. But it's what, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is a word that if you study again the Old Testament prophets, you hear as they call out Israel for their sins. Woe unto you, the prophets would cry. Jesus echoed the voice of the prophets in his own ministry. When he said to the Pharisees, they were surprised because they thought he would be calling out the prostitutes and the sinners and the cheaters and the scammers and the thieves and the criminals. But he looked at the Pharisees and he said, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees. That wasn't just you naughty little boy. No, what Jesus is saying, what the prophets are saying, what this eagle is crying out is, you better hold on for dear life because you are in big trouble now. If you thought it was bad, it's going to get a lot worse. And I feel, it's saying, I feel sorry for you. I can't believe what is about to just happen to you. This is a word of pending horror and astonishment. Notice it says three times, woe, woe, woe. Why? Not for the four things that just happened, but for the three that are getting ready to happen. And then if you notice, for instance, in verse 12 of chapter 9, it says, one woe is past. That's the fifth trumpet. And behold, still two more woes are coming. So the eagle wasn't just saying, whoa, 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 and then moving on. He was actually letting us know there are three woes coming up. One, two, three. And they are the three trumpets. And you can see on the slide how I've done this. Trumpet five is woe one, six is woe two, and seven is woe three. You can see again, later on, not just 9, 12, but also if you look in 11:14, now after, is that right? Yes. The second woe, sixth trumpet, is past. Behold, the third woe is coming soon. And so these are the three woes, the final three trumpet judgments. And yes, it does get worse when a crack opens on the surface of the earth and venomous locusts come up from the abyss and just crawl over the earth. We'll talk more about that. And then, even worse, a horde of demonic armies, horsemen breathing fire, are unleashed on the earth. And then worse yet, if you're a wicked person, the announcement, now God has showed up. If you think demonic armies are bad and locusts from hell are bad, God himself is worse. And that's the seventh trumpet. So what are we supposed to take out of this other than being scared out of our wits and then realizing I shouldn't be because I'm not going to be here? Since we're not going to be there, what are we supposed to take from this? Well, from a pastoral perspective, let's just make these observations. I think you can agree that our problems pale in significance to these things. So what are you complaining about? We're like that little kid who's screaming bloody murder because they cut their finger with a piece of paper and there's blood coming out. Oh, little child, you have no idea of the horrors that await you in your adult life. You think you're suffering now as a Christian, and I'm not going to list all the ways we suffer in America. We say, oh, depending on what side of the political aisle you're on, we're going to be suffering for 4 years now. Or some of you have been saying, we've been suffering for 4 years now. Or those of you who have gotten wise say, we suffer every 4 years no matter what. Oh, you don't suffer at all compared to the trumpet judgments, just the first four, not to mention the three woes that are to come. Also notice and take encouragement that powerful people will realize their powerlessness. If COVID has taught us anything, even a worldwide pandemic doesn't teach world rulers that they're not in charge. They still think they can control this thing, don't they? They still think that they can nickel and dime everything and manage it like they know what they're doing, don't they? And it's just a little volleyball that they argue about back and forth in the volleyball court. Okay, I'm telling you, when the trumpets are blown, there will be no politics that makes sense of it. All world rulers will realize, I have no power. I can't stop this. This is out of control. And right now, let them play their games. Let them feel powerful. Let's focus on our job, and that's bringing people to Christ under their noses. There's coming a day when no one will feel powerful. And finally, We can rest tonight and every night knowing that Christ stands in authority over the natural world. There's a degree to which people make choices, right? And that feels a little out of control, and God is even in control of people's out-of-control choices. But let's just face the facts. Nobody is in control of the natural world but the creator of the natural world. And this is why we need to be a little bit careful with some of the ways that our modern secular age is now spiritualizing scientific forces, imbuing them with some kind of a moral quality. I'm telling you, when these things happen, they are not going to be the result of some kind of global warming or whatever. That's not going to be the reason. And the world may try to say that. But the way John describes these things, at this point, they are not a part of natural processes. The things that are going to happen will be Christ himself hurling these things down from the stars. There's no science to that. That's pure judgment. Christ himself is in charge of the natural world. And let's argue from greater to less. If Christ is going to be in charge of those crazy things that happen, he's in charge of the things that happen today, whether they're hurricanes or forest fires or whatever they might be. He's in control of the natural world. And I can go to bed at night knowing my heavenly Father, my Lamb, my Lion in heaven, he pushes the buttons for all those things. The waves and the winds answer to his voice, not just in the tribulation, but today. And that's my God. And he's on my side. You may control politics, but you don't control the weather.